From The Mind in Comfort and Ease by the 14th Dalai Lama. The Importance of Bodhicitta. This bodhicitta is of extraordinary and crucial importance. Don't you find it truly moving the more you think about it? We should say to ourselves, while I live, I will meditate on bodhicitta. This is what will give meaning to my life. At the moment of death, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will help me to continue onward on my way toward enlightenment. When I am thriving and happy, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will enable me to use my prosperity to serve others and avoid the pitfalls of pride, envy, and lack of respect. When I face failure and sadness, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will prevent me from losing heart and losing hope. So, all the time and in any situation, in life, when death is near, in success or failure, in joy or sorrow, bodhicitta is something I cannot be without. From A Commentary on the Awakening Mind by Nagarjuna. Just as the blessed Buddhas and the great Bodhisattvas have generated the mind of great awakening, I too shall, from now on, until I arrive at the heart of awakening, generate the awakening mind, in order that I may save those who are not saved, free those who are not free, relieve those who are not relieved, and help thoroughly transcend sorrow those who have not thoroughly transcended sorrow. From the Sioux City, as quoted by Lama Jaitsong Kapa. In order to pacify the suffering of limitless sentient beings, to release them from bad migrations, liberate them from afflictions, and protect them completely from the varieties of sufferings when the discomforts of cyclic existence crowd in, I will generate the altruistic mind of enlightenment. May I always be a refuge for all destitute sentient beings, a protector of the protectorless, a support of those without a support, a refuge for the unprotected, maker of the miserable happy. May I cause the pacification of all sentient beings' afflictions. May whatever virtuous actions I have accumulated in this and other lives assume the aspects of the collections which are called merit and wisdom. May whatever effort I make by way of the six perfections be of benefit to all beings without there being any exception. Making effort until enlightenment, I will strive at actions temporarily and limitlessly over lives, so that, in short, all the afflictions of all sentient beings may be pacified and they be freed. From A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva. Chapter 1. The Benefit of the Awakening Mind. Respectfully, I prostrate myself to the Sugatas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya, as well as to their noble sons and to all who are worthy of veneration. Here I shall explain how to engage in the vows of the Buddha's sons, the meaning of which I have condensed in accordance with the scriptures. There is nothing here that has not been explained before, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. Therefore, lacking any intention to benefit others, I write this in order to acquaint it to my mind. For due to acquaintance with what is wholesome, the force of my faith may for a short while increase because of these words. If, however, these words are seen by others, equal in fortune to myself, may it be meaningful for them. Leisure and endowment are very hard to find, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for man, if I do not take advantage of them now, how will such a perfect opportunity come about again? Just as a flash of lightning on a dark, cloudy night, for an instant, brightly illuminates all. Likewise, in this world, through the might of Buddha, a wholesome thought rarely and briefly appears. Hence, virtue is perpetually feeble, the great strength of evil being extremely intense, and, except for a fully awakening mind, by what other virtue will it be overcome? All the Buddhas who have contemplated for many aeons have seen it to be beneficial, for by it the limitless masses of beings will quickly attain the supreme state of bliss. Those who wish to destroy the many sorrows of their conditioned existence, those who wish all beings to experience a multitude of joys, and those who wish to experience much happiness should never forsake the awakening mind. The moment an awakening mind arises in those fettered and weak in the jail of cyclic existence, they will be named a son of the Sugatas and will be revered by both men and gods of the world. It is like the supreme gold-making elixir, for it transforms the unclean body we have taken into the priceless jewel of a Buddha form. Therefore, firmly seize this awakening mind. Since the limitless mind of the sole guide of the world has, upon thorough investigation, seen its preciousness, all beings wishing to be free from worldly abodes should firmly take hold of this precious awakening mind. All other virtues are like the plantain tree, for after bearing fruit they simply perish. But the perennial tree of the awakening mind unceasingly bears fruit, and thereby flourishes without end. Like entrusting myself to a brave man when greatly afraid, by entrusting myself to this awakening mind, I shall be swiftly liberated, even if I have committed extremely unbearable evils. Why, then, do the conscientious not devote themselves to this? Just like the fire at the end of an age, it instantly consumes all great evil. Its unfathomable advantages were taught to the disciple Suddhana by the wise Lord Maitreya. In brief, the awakening mind should be understood to be of two types, the mind that aspires to awaken and the mind that ventures to do so. As is understood by the distinction between aspiring to go and actually going, so the wise understand in turn the distinction between these two. Although great fruits occur in cyclic existence from the mind that aspires to awaken, an uninterrupted flow of merit does not ensue as it does with the venturing mind. And for him who has perfectly seized this mind with the thought never to turn away from totally liberating the infinite forms of life, from that time hence, even while asleep or unconcerned, a force of merit equal to the sky will perpetually ensue. For the sake of those inclined toward the lesser vehicle, this was logically asserted by the Tathagata himself in the sutra requested by Subahu. If even the thought to relieve living creatures of merely a headache is a beneficial intention endowed with infinite goodness, then what need is there to mention the wish to dispel their inconceivable misery, wishing every single one of them to realize boundless good qualities? Do even fathers and mothers have such a benevolent intention as this? Do the gods and sages? Does even Brahma have it? If those beings have never before even dreamt of such an attitude for their own sake, how would it ever arise for the sake of others? This intention to benefit all beings, which does not arise in others even for their own sake, is an extraordinary jewel of the mind, and its birth is an unprecedented wonder. How can I fathom the depths of the goodness of this jewel of the mind, the panacea that relieves the world of pain and is the source of all its joy? If merely a benevolent intention excels venerating the Buddhas, then what need to mention striving to make all beings without exception happy? Although wishing to be rid of misery, they run toward misery itself. Although wishing to have happiness, like an enemy, they ignorantly destroy it. For those who are deprived of happiness and burdened with many sorrows, it satisfies them with all joys, dispels all suffering, and clears away confusion. Where is their comparable virtue? Where is there even such a friend? Where is their merit similar to this? If whoever repays a kind deed is worthy of some praise, then what need to mention the bodhisattva who does good without its being asked of him? The world honors as virtuous a man who sometimes gives a little plain food disrespectfully to a few beings that satisfies them for only half a day. What need be said then of one who eternally bestows the peerless bliss of the Sugatas upon limitless numbers of beings, thereby fulfilling all their hopes? The Buddha has said that whoever bears an evil thought against a benefactor, such as that bodhisattva, will remain in hell for as many aeons as there were evil thoughts. But if a virtuous attitude should arise in that regard, its fruits will multiply far more than that. When bodhisattvas suffer greatly, they generate no negativity. Instead, their virtues naturally increase. I bow down to the body of him in whom the sacred precious mind is born. I seek refuge in that source of joy who brings happiness even to those who harm him. Stabilizing in the Bodhi Mind by Shantideva. In the spiritual energy that relieves the anguish of beings in misery and places depressed beings in eternal joy, I lift up my heart and rejoice. In the goodness producing illumination, I lift up my heart and rejoice. I rejoice in the beings who have gained eternal liberation from suffering, and I rejoice in those attained to Buddhahood, as well as in their offspring, the noble bodhisattvas. In the ocean-like virtue of the Bodhi mind that brings joy to all beings and in accomplishing the well-being of others, I lift up my heart and rejoice. To the Buddhas of the 10 directions, I join my hands in respect. Let blaze the light of Dharma's truth for the beings lost in darkness. To the Buddhas considering parinirvana, I join my hands in prayer. Do not abandon the beings in sorrow, but remain and teach for countless ages. May any spiritual energy thus generated by my devotion to the enlightened ones be dedicated to dispelling the misery of living beings without exception. As long as diseases afflict living beings, may I be the doctor, the medicine, and also the nurse who restores them to health. May I fall as rain to increase the harvest that must feed the living beings, and in ages of dire famine, may I myself serve as food and drink. May I be an unending treasury for those desperate and forlorn. May I manifest as what they require and wish to have near them. My body, every possession, and all goodness, past, present, and future, without remorse, I dedicate to the well-being of the world. Suffering is transcended by total surrender, and the mind attains to nirvana. As one day all must be given up, why not dedicate it now to universal happiness? My bodily powers I dedicate to the well-being of all that lives. Should anyone wish to kill, abuse, or beat me, the responsibility is purely their own. Should anyone wish to ridicule me or make me an object of jest and scorn, why should I possibly care if I have dedicated myself to others? Let them do as they wish with me, so long as it does not harm them. May no one who encounters me ever have an insignificant contact. Regardless of whether those whom I meet respond toward me with anger or faith, May the mere fact of our meeting contribute to the fulfillment of their wishes. May the slander, harm, and all forms of abuse that anyone should direct toward me act as a cause of their enlightenment. May I be a protector of the helpless, a guide to those traveling the path, a boat to those wishing to cross over, or a bridge, or a raft. May I be land for those requiring it, a lamp for those in darkness. May I be a home for the homeless and a servant to the world. In order to fulfill the needs of beings, may I be as a magic gem, an inexhaustible vase, a mystic spell, a cure-all medicine, and a wish-granting tree. May I act as the mighty earth, or like the free and open skies, to support and provide the space whereby I and all others may grow. Until every being afflicted by pain has reached to Nirvana's shores, may I serve only as a condition that encourages progress and joy. Just as all previous Buddhas first gave rise to the precious Bodhi mind, and just as they then carefully followed the stages of the Bodhisattva disciplines, likewise, for the sake of living beings, do I now myself generate the Bodhi mind, and likewise will I myself train in the disciplines of a Bodhisattva. They who out of wisdom have seized the supreme Bodhi mind praise, glorify, and rejoice in it, that it may grow to fulfillment. From today I will reap the fruit of life, having well won the state of man. Today I am born in the Buddha family, and am now a child of the Buddhas. Thus, in future, I should make every effort to live in accord with the Bodhisattva ways, and never should I act as would bring shame to this noble, faultless family. Like a blind man fumbling in garbage happens to find a rare and precious gem, likewise I have discovered the jewel of the precious Bodhi mind. Thus was found this supreme ambrosia to dispel the lord of death, destroyer of life, an inexhaustible treasure able to cure the poverty of all sentient beings. It is the highest of medicines to quell the ills of the living, and is a tree giving shade to those wandering on the paths of life. It is a strong and mighty bridge by which beings can cross from misery, and it is a moon to shine in the mind to clear away the pains of delusion. The Bodhi mind is a great radiant sun to disperse the darkness of unknowing, and it is the very essence of butters gained from churning the milks of Dharma. For all guests on the road of life who would taste the very substance of joy, here is the actual seat of true happiness, a veritable feast to satiate the world. Thus today, in the presence of all awakened ones, I invite every living being to this festival, giving both immediate and lasting joy. May the gods and all others rejoice. The Excellence of Meditation upon the Bodhi Mind, by the 7th Dalai Lama. Honor to Buddha, the supreme sage, the cosmic overlord who awakens all beings from drunken ignorance by manifesting the hundredfold light of truth's brilliant door. Should even the earth be covered with a layer of lesser jewels, their radiance would be far surpassed by one fragment of a sparkling diamond. Similarly, does one with Bodhi mind outshine Hinayana followers. Of this thing called Bodhi mind, source of all spiritual qualities, the supremely significant, the psyche of a high one, the force producing all Buddhas, I now sing this praise. The expanded mind which thinks only of that which benefits others is a tree of endless fruit. One touch of its divine sap quenches even the word suffering. Merely looking at hunger and deprivation turns one's stomach with horror. Bodhi mind is the only medicine able to cure all forms of need, just as the Naga King's jewel fulfills the wants of even hungry ghosts. Animal passion which clouds the mind, animal stupidity blind to spiritual potential, the one sun to dispel them is Bodhi mind, torch of infinite rays. For destitute beggars at the door of the treasury of higher delights, Bodhi mind is the gatekeeper, and he fulfills mundane needs as well. Only Bodhi mind, the thought to be a Buddha, totally purges the ugliest of sins, sins which result in suffering, a fraction of which would break a man. It is a magic thing to destroy misery now and forever, a fabled potion to open the passage of a mother in labor. The soul thought on everyone's side, the precious mind aiming at enlightenment as a way to further the world, was seen by Buddha to be the highest of spiritual means. For the sake of both yourself and others, plant the fertile seed of Bodhi mind, which quickly produces the state of Buddha, freedom from every limitation, and make it firm as a mountain. Buddha said, by cultivating the seeds of Bodhi mind, all spiritual qualities are born. Those who have developed it, he called kings of doctors. It can be read in both the sutras and shastras that the Bodhi mind is the door to the Mahayana, and that the supreme practitioner who attains it becomes a bodhisattva, a son of the Buddhas. Whether or not one is a bodhisattva is decided by whether or not one has Bodhi mind. He is anointed with its sandalwood fragrance, is adorned by the richest of good qualities. Even the eagle, king of birds, cannot fly if he is missing a wing. Many find the wing perception of emptiness, but only those with the wing of Bodhi mind fly to the omniscient state of Buddhahood. Were the advantages of Bodhi mind to take form, the universe could not contain them. Generating it but for a moment produces more goodness than offering a world filled with the seven jewels to the Buddhas of the ten directions. This is but a drop from the ocean of the beneficial effects of Bodhi mind, all of which even Buddha could not describe. Therefore, wrap closely around your shoulders the cloak of love and enthusiasm, for this one path all Buddhas have trod, and become a living legend of one attained to freedom and knowledge. By virtue of this song on the elixir which transforms gross beings into beautiful golden Buddhas, may all living beings attain to a state of expanded mind. From the Gandavyuha Sutra. Sentient beings, trapped in aging and sickness, and tormented by 100 pains, seeing them assailed by the terrors of birth, death, and sorrow, he directs his conduct for their weal. Sentient beings, crushed by the wheels of suffering, within the circle of birth and death. Seeing this, he seeks the thunderbolt of wisdom that smashes to dust these wheels of woe. From The Sacred Heart Essence of the Pith Instructions by Nyosho Ken Rinpoche. The pure and supreme, precious bodhicitta, which is uncontrived, should arise in your being. Without this, there is no way to attain Buddhahood. So, firstly, the excellent preparation of generating the altruistic mind of enlightenment is important. Of all beings in the universe, none have not been our parents. Through their great kindness, they formed our body, gave life and material goods, and showed us the ways of the world. Although they desire only happiness, they are like a blind person without a guiding friend. In order that all beings tormented in unbearable cyclic existence accomplish everlasting peace, unsurpassable enlightenment, motivated by the altruistic objective of the twofold benefit with both their aspects, you should generate the supreme mind intent upon attaining perfect enlightenment. This bodhicitta is the all-sufficient wish-fulfilling jewel. This is the foundation of all the vast and profound teachings. This is the central point of all the paths of sutra and tantra. One aspect of the nature of the two truths is the relative level, the principal theme of all practice, the king of all supreme methods. Without this, there is no other means to accomplish Buddhahood. If you lack either method or wisdom, how will the path be accomplished? Of the two supreme paths, First, the path of skillful means is praised for the preparation on the path generate the bodhicitta. This has immeasurable benefits, the all-knowing Lord Maitreya said to Narzang. The bodhicitta is like the moon which eliminates darkness. Bodhicitta is like the all-illuminating sun. Bodhicitta expels the chronic disease of obscuring emotions. Bodhicitta protects from the terrors of samsara. Bodhicitta repels the obstacles of the four demons. Bodhicitta eliminates the fever of the five poisons. Bodhicitta acts as the stallion of an endeavor. Bodhicitta is the sturdy armor of patience. Bodhicitta discards all moral downfalls. Bodhicitta supports the accomplishment of meditative concentration. Bodhicitta gives birth to excellent tranquility. Bodhicitta causes supreme wisdom to arise in the mind. Bodhicitta perfects the great accumulation of merit. Bodhicitta brings forth the view of emptiness. When bodhicitta is present, the moon of skillful means rises. If you meditate on bodhicitta, the sun of penetrating insight is evident. If you meditate on bodhicitta, pristine awareness fully unfolds. By bodhicitta, the benefit of others effortlessly arises. Through bodhicitta, the qualities of the 10 bodhisattva levels are perfected. All the relative qualities and the 112 freedoms of the great bodhisattvas dwelling on the first level up to the innumerable, ineffable, immeasurable wisdom eyes, clairvoyances, miraculous powers, and so forth, as well as the 32 major and minor signs of the countless sugatas' golden bodies, and so on. All these enlightenment qualities arising from the accumulation of merit stem from the power of supreme, unsurpassable bodhicitta. Bodhicitta subdues the demon of ego-clinging. Bodhicitta frees from the prison of samsara. Bodhicitta evaporates the ocean of suffering. Bodhicitta equalizes suffering and happiness. Bodhicitta is like a brave escort. Bodhicitta is like the great fire at the end of an aeon. Bodhicitta is like the first fruit of a tree. Bodhicitta opens the door to the treasury of altruism. Lacking such profound and supreme bodhicitta, like powerful ram who dwelt 12 years in the forest but was driven by the goad of attachment to fight his enemies, or like Gelong Thangpa, who, although he could fly freely in the sky, through having mastered energy and mind, started a battle, the fault was the absence of unsurpassing bodhicitta. Brahma himself, even after attaining desireless bliss, will become blazing firewood in a vichy hell, and Indra, though venerated by the entire world, by the power of karma will fall back to the ground. Lacking the kingly mountain of bodhicitta is the fault. In this world, so many of those glorified by the highest rank, like great kings, generals, prime ministers, and presidents, finally destroyed themselves and others. The fault lay with the rotten root of bodhicitta. Innumerable Sravakas, Pratyekas, Buddhas, and hosts of other superior beings, possessing the 250 vows of pure ethical discipline. But although beautified by the three trainings, related practices, experience, and realization, without bodhicitta, the root of all dharma, sometimes liberating only themselves, they remained in great peace. From among the vast divisions of the Buddha's teaching, bodhicitta is the very quintessence. Bodhicitta repels the harm of the lower realms. Bodhicitta reveals the supreme path of liberation. If the yogin possesses bodhicitta, even if he doesn't accomplish any virtue through body and speech, he will not stray from the path of liberation. Thus said Choki Wangpo, who had mastered the five sciences. The five heinous evils, etc., all great negative actions, will be overpowered by the unsurpassable bodhicitta, and all lesser sins will also be removed, said the great Indian pandit Shantideva. Whoever abides in the supreme bodhicitta, their life will be regarded as a pleasant garden, whether successful or even destitute, The miseries of the lower realms won't terrify, Lord Maitreya stated in the Sutra Lamkara. In brief, the unsurpassable precious bodhicitta is the heart essence of all the Buddhas of the three times. Since without it there is no way to accomplish enlightenment, it is the authentic root of the path of sutras, tantras, and pith instructions. This excellent preparatory practice of generating bodhicitta is praised with one voice by all the millions of past holy ones. It should not become mere intellectual knowledge, but should be reflected upon again and again and united with your being, my heart friends. It is not said merely for the lack of something to say, but emphasized because of its great importance. So train your mind with bodhicitta, my heart friends. Don't be distracted. Don't be distracted. Train in bodhicitta. Don't be mistaken. Don't be mistaken. Train in bodhicitta. Don't err. Don't err. Train in bodhicitta. If the foundation of bodhicitta is not firm, the extremely profound essential pith instructions of the creative and completion phases and other practices will be difficult to perfect. So the preparatory generation of bodhicitta is the starting point on the path. Think of the great aim. Bodhicitta is the aim to become a Buddha in order to bring the greatest benefit to all sentient beings. Vow. From this point forward, I dedicate myself to removing the suffering of all living beings and to bringing them all happiness. I dedicate myself fully to their healing and awakening, to their having comfort, strength of body, mind, and spirit, most excellent nourishment, health, longevity, every level of protection, shelter, food, clothing, medicine, education, joy, and wisdom. In order to accomplish the needs of living beings in the most effective way, I will develop my wisdom and compassion just as my teachers have done. I aim to become free of all faults and complete in all qualities, and day by day, hour by hour, to always offer as much help as I can. In this way, I will make a gift of my life. In this way, my own life will be fulfilled. I dedicate myself fully, leaving nothing out, to the complete healing, fulfillment, and enlightenment of living beings. No matter how long it takes, no matter how difficult it may be, no matter what it costs. With all my heart and with all my strength, I vow to always serve all living beings in every way that is necessary for them, and in every way that will bring each and every one of them true and lasting health and happiness. Eight Verses for Training the Mind by Langtry Dangpa. May I always cherish all beings with the resolve to accomplish for them the highest good that is more precious than any wish-fulfilling jewel. When among others, I will think of myself as lowest among all, and will hold others to be supreme from the very depths of my heart. I will learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering both self and others, I will firmly face and avert it. When meeting with those who have especially strong sins and suffering, I will learn to cherish them as if I had found a precious treasure very difficult to find. When others treat me badly with slander, abuse, and so on, I will accept all loss and offer the victory to them. When one I have benefited hurts me, I will learn to view that one as my own supreme guru. In short, I will learn to offer all help and happiness to all beings, both directly and indirectly, and I will remove as much suffering as these beings may have. I will keep these practices undiminished by the usual worldly preoccupations, and by knowing appearances to be like illusions, I will be without the limitations that accompany ego grasping. From A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva. Chapter 7. Enthusiasm. Having patience, I should develop enthusiasm, for awakening will dwell only in those who exert themselves. Just as there is no movement without wind, so merit does not occur without enthusiasm. What is enthusiasm? It is finding joy in what is wholesome. Its opposing factors are explained as laziness, attraction to what is bad, and despising oneself out of despondency. Because of attachment to the pleasurable taste of idleness, because of craving for sleep, and because of having no disillusion with the misery of cyclic existence, laziness grows very strong. Enmeshed in the snare of disturbing conceptions, I have entered the snare of birth. Why am I not aware that I live in the mouth of the Lord of Death? Do I not see that he is systematically slaughtering my species? Whoever remains soundly asleep surely behaves like a buffalo with a butcher. When, having blocked off every escape route, the Lord of Death is looking for someone to kill, how can I enjoy eating, and likewise, how can I enjoy sleep? For as long as death is actually approaching, then I shall accumulate merits. Even if I then put a stop to laziness, what will be the use? That is not the time. When this has not been done, when this is being done, and when this is only half finished, suddenly the Lord of Death will come, and the thought will occur, "Oh no, I am done for." Their faces flowing with tears, their eyes red and swollen with sorrow, my relatives will finally lose hope, and I shall behold the vision of the messengers of death. Tormented by the memory of my evils and hearing the sounds of hell, in terror I shall clothe my body in excrement. What virtue can I do in such a delirious state? If even in this life I shall be gripped with fear, like that of a live fish being rolled in hot sand, why mention the unbearable agonies of hell that will result from my unwholesome deeds? How can I remain at ease like this when I have committed the actions that will bear fruit in my delicate infant's body encountering boiling acids in the hell of tremendous heat? Much harm befalls those with little forbearance and those who want results without making any effort. While clasped by death, they shall cry like the gods, "Oh no, I am overcome by misery." Relying upon the boat of a human body, free yourself from the great river of pain. As it is hard to find this boat again, this is no time for sleep, you fool. Having rejected the supreme joy of the sacred Dharma, this is a boundless source of delight. Why am I distracted by the causes of pain? Why do I enjoy frivolous amusements and the like? Without indulging in despondency, I should gather the supports for enthusiasm and earnestly take control of myself. Then, by seeing the equality between self and others, I should practice exchanging self for others. I should never indulge in despondency by entertaining such thoughts as, "How shall I ever awaken?" For the Tathagatas who speak what is true have uttered this truth. If they develop the strength of their exertion, even those who are flies, mosquitoes, bees, and insects will win the unsurpassable awakening, which is so hard to find. So, if I do not forsake the Bodhisattva's way of life, why should someone like myself, who has been born in the human race, not attain awakening, since I am able to recognize what is beneficial and what is of harm? But, nevertheless, it frightens me to think that I may have to give away my arms and legs without discriminating between what is heavy and what is light. I am reduced to fear through confusion. For over countless myriads of eons, I have been cut, stabbed, burned, and flayed alive innumerable times, but I have not awakened. Yet the suffering involved in my awakening will have a limit. It is like the suffering of having an incision made in order to remove and destroy greater pain. Even doctors eliminate illness with unpleasant medical treatments. So, in order to overcome manifold sufferings, I should be able to put up with some discomfort. But the Supreme Physician does not employ common medical treatments such as these. With an extremely gentle technique, he remedies all the greatest ills. At the beginning, the guide of the world encourages the giving of such things as food. Later, when accustomed to this, one may progressively start to give away even one's flesh. At such a time when my mind is developed to the point of regarding my body like food, then what hardship would there be when it came to giving away my flesh? Having forsaken all evil, there would be no suffering, and, due to wisdom, there would be no lack of joy. But now my mind is afflicted by mistaken conceptions, and my body is caused harm by unwholesome deeds. As their bodies are happy due to their merits, and their minds are happy due to their wisdom, if even they remained in cyclic existence for the sake of others, why would the compassionate ones ever be upset? Due to the strength of his awakening mind, the Bodhisattva consumes his previous evils and harvests oceans of merit. Hence, he is said to excel the Shravakas. So, having mounted on the horse of an awakening mind that dispels all discouragement and weariness, who, when they know of this mind that proceeds from joy to joy, would ever lapse into despondency? The supports, when working for the sake of living beings, are aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and rest. Aspiration is developed through fear of misery and by contemplating the benefits of aspiration itself. Thus, in order to increase my enthusiasm, I should strive to abandon its opposing forces, to amass the supports of aspiration, self-confidence, joy, and rest, to practice in earnest, and to become strong in self-control. I shall have to overcome the boundless faults of myself and others, and, in order to destroy each of these faults alone, I may have to strive until an ocean of eons is exhausted. But if within myself I do not perceive even a fraction of the perseverance required to exhaust these faults, then why do I not have a heart attack, for now I have become an abode for infinite misery? Likewise, I shall have to realize many excellent qualities for myself and others, and in order to attain each of these qualities alone, I may have to acquaint myself with its cause until an ocean of eons is exhausted. But I have never developed acquaintance with even a fraction of these excellences. How strange it is to squander this birth I have found by some coincidence. I have not made offerings to the Lord Buddhas. I have not given the pleasure of great festivals. I have not performed actions for the teachings. I have not fulfilled the wishes of the poor. I have not granted fearlessness to the frightened, and I have not given happiness to the weak. All I have given rise to is the agonies in the mother's womb and to suffering. Both now and in previous lives, such deprivation has arisen because of my lack of aspiring for the Dharma. Who would ever reject this aspiring for Dharma? The Mighty One himself has said that aspiration is the root of every facet of virtue. Its root is constant acquaintance with the ripening effects of actions. Physical pain, mental unhappiness, all the various kinds of fear, as well as separation from what is desired, all arise from an unwholesome way of life. However, by committing wholesome actions, which are motivated by aspiration in the mind, wherever I go, I shall be presented with tokens of the fruit of that merit. But by committing evil actions, although I may wish for happiness, wherever I go, I shall be completely overcome by the weapons of pain caused by my evil life. As a result of virtue, I shall dwell in the spacious, fragrant, and cool heart of a lotus flower. My radiance will be nourished by the food of the conqueror's sweet speech. My glorious form will spring from a lotus unfolded by the mighty one's light. And as a bodhisattva, I shall abide in the presence of the conquerors. But as a result of my non-virtue, my skin will be ripped off by the henchmen of Yama. In this feeble state, liquid copper, melted by tremendous heat, will be poured onto my body. Pierced by flaming swords and daggers, my flesh will be cut into 100 pieces, and I shall tremble upon fiercely blazing iron ground. Therefore, I should aspire for virtue, and with great respect acquaint myself with it. Having undertaken the wholesome in the manner of Vajradhara, I should then proceed to acquaint myself with self-confidence. First of all, I should examine well what is to be done to see whether I can pursue it or cannot undertake it. If I am unable, it is best to leave it, but once I have started, I must not withdraw. If I do, then this habit will continue in other lives, and evil and misery will increase. Also, other actions done at the time of its fruition will be weak and will not be accomplished. Self-confidence should be applied to wholesome actions, the overcoming of disturbing conceptions, and my ability to do this. Thinking, I alone shall do it, is the self-confidence of action. Powerless, their minds disturbed, people in this world are unable to benefit themselves. Therefore, I shall do it for them, since unlike me, these beings are incapable. Even if others are doing inferior tasks, why should I sit here doing nothing? I do not do those tasks because of self-importance. It would be best for me to have no such pride. When crows encounter a dying snake, they will act as though they were eagles. Likewise, if my self-confidence is weak, I shall be injured by the slightest downfall. How can those who, out of faint-heartedness, have given up trying, find liberation because of this deficiency? But even the greatest obstacle will find it hard to overcome. Therefore, with a steady mind, I shall overcome all falls. For if I am defeated by a fall, my wish to vanquish the three realms will become a joke. I will conquer everything, and nothing at all shall conquer me. I, a son of the lion-like conqueror, should remain self-confident in this way. Whoever has self-importance is destroyed by it. He is disturbed and has no self-confidence. For those with self-confidence do not succumb to the power of the enemy, whereas the former are under the sway of the enemy of self-importance. Inflated by the disturbing conception of my self-importance, I shall be led by it to the lower realms. It destroys the joyous festival of being human. I shall become a slave, eating the food of others, stupid, ugly, feeble, and everywhere disrespected. Tough people, bloated by conceit, are also counted among the self-important. Tell me, what is more pathetic than this? Whoever seizes self-confidence in order to conquer the enemy of self-importance, he is the self-confident one, the victorious hero. And in addition, whoever definitely conquers the spread of this enemy, self-importance, completely wins the fruit of a conqueror, fulfilling the wishes of the world. If I find myself amidst a crowd of disturbing conceptions, I shall endure them in 1,000 ways, like a lion amongst foxes. I will not be affected by this disturbing host. Just as men will guard their eyes when great danger and turmoil occur, likewise I shall never be swayed by the disturbances within my mind, even at times of great strife. It would be better for me to be burned, to have my head cut off and to be killed, rather than ever bowing down to those ever-present disturbing conceptions. So, likewise, in all situations, I should do nothing other than what is fit. Just like those who yearn for the fruits of play, a bodhisattva is attracted to whatever task he may do. He never has enough. It only brings him joy. Although people work in order to be happy, it is uncertain whether or not they will find it. But how can those whose work itself is joy find happiness unless they do it? If I feel that I never have enough sensual objects, which are like honey smeared upon a razor's edge, then why should I ever feel that I have enough merit which ripens in happiness and peace? Thus, in order to complete this task, I shall venture into it, just as an elephant, tormented by the midday sun, plunges into a cool, refreshing lake. When my strength declines, I should leave whatever I am doing in order to be able to continue with it later. Having done something well, I should put it aside with the wish to accomplish what will follow. Just as an old warrior approaches the swords of an enemy upon the battlefront, so shall I avoid the weapons of the disturbing conceptions and skillfully bind this enemy. If someone dropped his sword during a battle, he would immediately pick it up out of fear. Likewise, if I lose the weapon of mindfulness, I should quickly retrieve it, being afraid of hell. Just as poison spreads throughout the body in dependence upon the circulation of blood, likewise, if a disturbing conception finds an opportunity, unwholesomeness will permeate my mind. Those who practice should be as attentive as a frightened man carrying a jar full of mustard oil, who is being threatened by someone with a sword that he will be killed if he spills just one drop. Just as I would swiftly stand up if a snake came into my lap, likewise, if any sleep or laziness occur, I shall quickly turn them back. Each time something unwholesome occurs, I should criticize myself and then contemplate for a long time that I shall never let this happen again. Likewise, in all these situations, I shall acquaint myself with mindfulness. With this motivation as a cause, I shall aspire to meet with teachers or accomplish the tasks they assign me. In order to have the strength for everything, I should recall before undertaking any action the advice in the chapter on conscientiousness, and then joyfully rise to the task. Just as the wind blowing back and forth controls the movement of a piece of cotton, so shall I be controlled by joy, and in this way accomplish everything. The 37 Verses on the Practice of a Bodhisattva by Thogme Zangpo. Namo Lokeshvaraya. Though he sees that in all phenomena there is no coming and going, he strives solely for the sake of beings. To the sublime teacher, inseparable from Avalokiteshvara, the protector of beings, I pay constant homage with respectful body, speech, and mind. The perfect Buddhas, source of happiness and ultimate peace, exist through having accomplished the sacred Dharma, and that in turn depends on knowing how to practice it. This practice of the Bodhisattvas I shall therefore now explain. Now that I have this great ship, a precious human life, so hard to obtain, I must carry myself and others across the ocean of samsara. To that end, to listen, reflect, and meditate day and night without distraction is the practice of a bodhisattva. In my native land, waves of attachment to friends and kin surge. Hatred for enemies rages like fire. The darkness of stupidity, not caring what to adapt or avoid, thickens. To abandon my native land is the practice of a bodhisattva. When unfavorable places are abandoned, disturbing emotions gradually fade. When there are no distractions, positive activities naturally increase. As awareness becomes clearer, confidence in the Dharma grows. To rely on solitude is the practice of a bodhisattva. Close friends who have long been together will separate. wealth and possessions gained with much effort will be left behind. Consciousness, a guest, will leave the hotel of the body. To give up the concerns of this life is the practice of a bodhisattva. In bad company, the three poisons grow stronger. Listening, reflection, and meditation decline, and loving kindness and compassion vanish. To avoid unsuitable friends is the practice of a bodhisattva. Through reliance on a true spiritual friend, one's faults will fade and good qualities will grow like a waxing moon. To consider him even more precious than one's own body is the practice of a bodhisattva. Whom can worldly gods protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara? To take refuge in the three jewels, who never fail those they protect, is the practice of a bodhisattva. The Buddha taught that the unendurable suffering of the lower realms is the fruit of unvirtuous actions. Therefore, to never act unvirtuously, even at the cost of one's life, is the practice of a bodhisattva. Like dew on grass, the delights of the three worlds, by their very nature, evaporate in an instant. To strive for the supreme level of liberation, which never changes, is the practice of a bodhisattva. If all the mothers who have loved me since beginningless time are suffering, what is the use of my own happiness? So, with the aim of liberating limitless sentient beings, to set my mind on enlightenment is the practice of a bodhisattva. All suffering, without exception, arises from desiring happiness for myself, while perfect Buddhahood is born from the thought of benefiting others. Therefore, to really exchange my own happiness for the suffering of others is the practice of a bodhisattva. If someone driven by great desire seizes all my wealth, or induces others to do so, to dedicate to him my body, possessions, and past, present, and future merit is the practice of a bodhisattva. If, in return for not the slightest wrong of mine, someone were to cut off even my very head, through the power of compassion to take all his negative actions upon myself is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if someone says all sorts of derogatory things about me and proclaims them throughout the universe, in return, out of loving kindness, to extol that person's qualities is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if, in the midst of a large gathering, someone exposes my hidden faults with insulting language, to bow to him respectfully, regarding him as a spiritual friend, is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if one I've lovingly cared for like my own child regards me as an enemy, to love him even more as a mother loves a sick child is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even if my peers or my inferiors out of pride do all they can to debase me, to respectfully consider them like my teachers on the crown of my head is the practice of a bodhisattva. Even when utterly destitute and constantly maligned by others, afflicted by terrible illness and prey to evil forces, to draw upon myself the suffering and wrongdoing of all beings and not lose heart is the practice of a bodhisattva. Though I may be famous and revered by many and rich as the god of wealth himself, to see that wealth and glory of the world are without essence and to be free of arrogance is the practice of a bodhisattva. If one does not conquer one's own hatred, the more one fights outer enemies, the more they will increase. Therefore, with the armies of loving kindness and compassion, to tame one's own mind is the practice of a bodhisattva. Sense pleasures and desirable things are like salt water. The more one tastes them, the more one's thirst increases. To abandon promptly all objects which arouse attachment is the practice of a bodhisattva. All that appears is the work of one's own mind. The nature of mind is primordially free from conceptual limitations. To recognize this nature, and not to entertain concepts of subject and object, is the practice of a bodhisattva. When encountering objects which please us, to view them like rainbows in summer, not ultimately real, however beautiful they appear, and to relinquish craving and attachment is the practice of a bodhisattva. The various forms of suffering are like the death of one's child in a dream. By clinging to deluded perceptions as real, we exhaust ourselves. Therefore, when encountering unfavorable circumstances, to view them as illusions is the practice of a bodhisattva. If those who wish for enlightenment must give away even their own bodies, how much more should it be true of material objects? Therefore, without expectation of result or reward, to give generously is the practice of a bodhisattva. If, lacking discipline, one cannot accomplish one's own good, it is laughable to think of accomplishing the good of others. Therefore, to observe discipline without samsaric motives is the practice of a bodhisattva. For a bodhisattva who desires the joys of virtue, all who harm him are like a precious treasure. Therefore, to cultivate patience toward all without resentment is the practice of a bodhisattva. Merely for their own sake, even Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas make efforts like someone whose hair is on fire, trying to put it out. Seeing this, for the sake of all beings, to practice diligence, the source of excellent qualities, is the practice of a bodhisattva. Knowing that through profound insight, thoroughly grounded in sustained calm, the disturbing emotions are completely conquered. To practice the concentration which utterly transcends the four formless states is the practice of a bodhisattva. In the absence of wisdom, perfect enlightenment cannot be attained through the other five perfections alone. Therefore, to cultivate wisdom combined with skillful means and free from the three concepts is the practice of a bodhisattva. If I do not examine my own defects, though outwardly a Dharma practitioner, I may act contrary to the Dharma. Therefore, continuously to examine my own faults and give them up is the practice of a bodhisattva. If, impelled by negative emotions, I relate the faults of other bodhisattvas, I will myself degenerate. Therefore, to not talk about the faults of anyone who has entered the Mahayana is the practice of a bodhisattva. Offerings and respect may bring discord and cause listening, reflection, and meditation to decline. Therefore, to avoid attachment to the homes of friends and benefactors is the practice of a bodhisattva. Harsh words disturb the minds of others and spoil our own bodhisattva practice. Therefore, to give up rough speech, which others find unpleasant, is the practice of a bodhisattva. When emotions become habitual, they are hard to get rid of with antidotes. Therefore, with mindfulness and vigilance, to seize the weapon of the antidote and crush attachment and other negative emotions the moment they arise is the practice of a bodhisattva. In short, wherever I am, whatever I do, to be continually alert and mindful, asking what is the state of my mind, and accomplishing the good of others is the practice of a bodhisattva. Dedicating to enlightenment through wisdom purified of the three concepts, all merit achieved by such endeavor to remove the suffering of numberless beings is the practice of a bodhisattva. Following the teachings of the holy beings, I have arranged the points taught in the sutras, tantras, and shastras as the 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva for the benefit of those who wish to train on the bodhisattva path. Since my understanding is poor and I have little education, this is no composition to delight the learned, but as it is based on the sutras and the teachings of holy beings, I think it is genuinely the practice of the bodhisattvas. However, it is hard for someone unintelligent like me to fathom the great waves of bodhisattvas' activities, so I beg the forgiveness of the holy ones for any contradictions, irrelevancies, and other mistakes. Through the merit arising from this, and through the power of the sublime bodhicitta, relative and absolute, may all beings become like the Lord Avalokiteshvara, who is beyond the extremes of samsara and nirvana. For his own benefit and that of others, Dogme, a teacher of scripture and logic, composed this text at Richenpug in Ngulchu.